So thanks to David Schmidt for giving the first Quantum Foundations virtual seminar at Perimeter. David said he's happy to take questions during the seminar. So I guess we can do that either by using the chat feature or just unmuting, asking the question, and then remuting. If you're not speaking, please mute. I think that's it. So please, David, take us away.
Thanks, Lucien. Right, yeah, so you're probably more likely to get a response if you speak audibly rather than send a chat, because I might miss chats, but hopefully I won't. So yeah, thanks for tuning in, everybody, to this Zoom seminar. So I'm going to tell you about some joint work that you can find on the archive that was done with my supervisor, Rob Speckens, and my colleagues, TC, Ravi, Belen, and Ellie. And in particular, I'm going to try to convince you that standard entanglement theory is inappropriate for the study of Bell scenarios. And I'm going to try to motivate you to study the resource theory of local operations and shared randomness, rather than local operations and classical communication, as defining the appropriate notion of entanglement theory in these cases. So, first of all, what is entanglement? Well, Schrodinger was the first person to recognize this as an important concept in quantum theory. He was thinking about pure states, and he recognized that some of these are not just the tensor product of the two components. And for pure states, that was what he took to be entangled. But as the quantum information community turned its attention to mixed states, we needed a more general definition. So a generic state is said to be entangled if it's not separable, not a mixture of product states. And then as time went on, it was realized entanglement was useful as a resource for tasks like teleportation, where the parties have access to local operations and classical communication, or LOCC operations. And over time, entanglement came to be understood as the resource which cannot be generated by LOCC operations. And this is useful because it lets you quantify entanglement. You can define entanglement quantitatively as the resource which is characterized by convertibility under local operations and classical communication. And what I mean by this is a state row one is at least as entangled as a state row two, if and only if row one can be converted to row two using local operations and classical communication. And you can, from this basic definition, you can define measures of entanglement and essentially the entire resource theory of entanglement as a resource. But I want to point out that this isn't the only possible definition that's consistent with the qualitative divide between separable and non-separable states. In fact, if rather than having access to classical communication, the parties only have access to local operations and shared randomness, so this definition changes by LOCC changing to LOSR. This also reproduces the qualitative divide between separable states and non-separable states. So you kind of, once you recognize this possibility, you need to justify why you should study one or the other of these possible quantitative generalizations of the qualitative notion of entanglement. And to do that, to motivate which of these is relevant in a given context, it's going to be helpful to have some resource theory preliminaries. Okay, so what is a resource theory? Well, it starts with a process theory. And a process theory is pretty simple. It's a set of systems, which in our case will be Hilbert spaces, and a set of processes, which might be states or channels, whatever the resources in question are. So here we might have states or bipartite states, channels, bipartite channels, and so on. And we assume in a process theory that any composition of these processes yields another process that's also in the theory. So it's closed under parallel and sequential composition. And the only extra piece of structure we need to define a resource theory is a subtheory of processes which are deemed free. So these are the processes that we imagine, at least in some idealized limit, you can prepare in unlimited quantity, or you can implement in unlimited quantity. And again, we assume that this subtheory is closed under parallel and sequential composition. And so that's how we define a resource theory. It's a partitioned process theory, namely a process theory with a set of all resources and a subtheory of free processes And anything that's not in the sub-theory that's still in the theory is a valuable resource. And the free sub-theory induces some structure on the valuable resources to tell you which ones are more or less valuable. And this was introduced in this paper here. So in particular, the possible conversions between state resources tells you which states are more or less valuable. So we say that a resource R can be converted into a resource S, and we denote that like this with this arrow between the two, if and only if there exists some free channel which you can compose with R to generate S. And in this case, we say that the state R is at least as valuable as the state S in the sense of this particular resource theory that we're considering. We can also talk about the conversion of channel resources. So we say that channel F can be converted into channel G, which we write like this, if and only if there exists some processes in the free theory which we can compose with F, as shown here, to generate G. And note that the most general type of operation we can do here, converting a channel to a channel, is not just a pre-processing of the input here at A and a post-processing of the output at B, but also we need to allow for some kind of side channel here. And this is often called a comb because it kind of slots around F, as you can see, like the teeth of a comb. And in this case, we say that F is at least as valuable as G. So that is how we place value on resources, whether they be states or channels. And I should point out that you can also consider conversions from one type to another type. So from states to channels or channels to states or whatever types you're considering, you just compose with the appropriately typed free processes in your resource theory. And so you can compare the value of resources across types as well. And these conversion relations then induce, mathematically, they induce a pre-order over resources. Here's an example, a simple example of what that might look like. So we say, for example, that R3 is equally as valuable as R3 prime, because given either one, you can freely convert it into the other. And we might also say that they're in the same equivalence class. R1, in contrast, is strictly more valuable than R4, because given R1, you can freely convert it to R4, but you can't convert R4 back into R1. And R1 and R2 are incomparable, so neither one can be converted into the other. There will be some tasks for which R1 is more useful and some tasks for which R2 is more useful. But you can't say that one is strictly more, or neither is more valuable than the other. They're just incomparable. And in this particular case, R1 and R2 are both maximally valuable in the sense that nothing is more valuable than them. But note that there's not a unique maximally resourceful object in this particular preorder. So the preorder is the key object of interest in a resource theory. It tells you everything you need to know about the relative value of any pair of resources. And it can be very complicated. So often we introduce measures of a resource that give us some partial information about that preorder. So definition, a function M from resources to the real numbers is a resource monotone or measure if it is non-increasing under the free operations. So that makes sense. It says you can't generate value for free. And you've probably heard of some of these in the context of LOCC entanglement theory, negativity, von Neumann entropy, and so on. Graphically, you can think of it as a function that respects the preorder. So here, if this is a simple example of a preorder, and these are the level sets of a monotone, decreasing as you go downwards, then you see that under any free operation, any of these blue arrows, you never increase the value of this monotone. So it's a valid monotone. And as soon as you have any incomparability in your preorder, so anything other than a total order, there won't be a single measure up to which all other measures are effectively equivalent. So here we see R2 and R3 are incomparable, which means there will be some monotone that orders them one way, as M1 does, but there will necessarily be at least one other monotone which orders them in the other way. So here's a separate monotone, M2, which does that. Okay, so that's all we need for the basics of a resource theory in the abstract. Let's specialize now to the types of resources that we're going to be interested in. And I'm going to use a graphical notation where classical systems will be represented by a single wire and quantum systems will be represented by a double wire. So the first type of resource is a state. So here's a bipartite quantum state. It's an object living on two quantum systems. And formally, it's a density operator. And the second type of resource is a box. So a box is a channel from classical inputs to classical outputs. Here's a bipartite box. Formally, it's a conditional probability distribution, P of AB given XY. So this is like the correlations you observe in a Bell scenario. And a state is said to be separable if it's either a product, a tensor product of states, or a mixture of tensor products. So this is the definition of separable, sort of graphically. And if it's not separable, then it's said to be entangled. Whereas a box is said to have a hidden variable model if it decomposes as either a product of conditional probability distributions or a mixture thereof. That's what Fine's theorem says. Alternatively, you can just think of this as a hidden variable in this green box is copied and sent to the two parties and then classically post-processed in this way to generate the box. Any such box has a hidden variable model. It's often said to be a local box. And if a box does not have such a decomposition, then it's said to be non-local. So this sets up graphically what the divide between free and non-free is. Free are the objects, whether states or boxes, that have decompositions of this form. And note that this is exactly the decomposition into LOSR free. This is the most general LOSR free state and the most general LOSR free box. And anything that's LOSR non-free is either entangled if it's a state or it's non-local if it's a box. So already we can see that manifestly this resource theory of LOSR has reproduced the qualitative divide between what's classical and non-classical for both states and boxes in a way that LOCC entanglement theory doesn't sort of manifestly do, although it does also reproduce this divide for states at least. Okay, but choosing the appropriate set of free operations is the key step in defining a resource theory. So we need to think carefully about this question. Are the relevant free operations for studying entanglement LOCC, or are they LOSR? So we argued that LOSR entanglement is the appropriate one, the appropriate choice of free operations for defining a resource theory in Bell scenarios, and hence also for defining resourcefulness for key distribution and randomness generation as well, since these are built around non-locality. We're not going to contest the fact that LOCC entanglement is appropriate in some contexts, such as for teleportation. And it's not hard to see that this is how the chips are going to fall, because if we look at the natural causal structure of teleportation, Alice and Bob share a bipartite entangled state. Alice wants to teleport the system to Bob, so she implements a joint measurement on her system together with her half of the entangled state, gets a classical outcome, communicates that to Bob, who does a local operation. And if they choose these operations appropriately, they can implement an effective identity transformation from Alice's input system to Bob's output system. And you can see that this protocol explicitly requires the agents to have access to classical communication. So it's not surprising that LOCC entanglement is useful for studying teleportation. But if we look at a Bell scenario, Alice and Bob share some bipartite entangled state. Alice performs one of a set of measurements based on some classical setting value and gets some classical outcome value. And Bob does similarly. And you can see that there's no sort of inherent classical communication in this setting. And furthermore, if you're willing to stipulate that in a Bell scenario, all the operations are at space-like separation, then that immediately just rules out classical communication. Or alternatively, if you're willing to stipulate that the causal structure in a Bell scenario is a common cause, that also rules out classical communication. Now, of course, the parties can still observe correlations, and these correlations could come about from shared randomness or from a quantum common cause like an entangled state. But if one wants to study non-classicality, then one takes as free the stuff that's classical, so that as soon as you have something non-free or valuable, it'll be non-classical. And that gets you down to the set of free operations, LOSR, in the Bell scenario. So we give an additional argument for LOSR and Bell scenarios in this paper. I'll just point out the salient features here. So we assume that the goal is to find a unified resource theory of entanglement and non-locality. And what I mean by that is that we want to be able to discuss conversions from boxes to boxes. That's what we need to do to order different boxes in terms of which ones are more or less non-local. We also want to be able to order states. So we need to talk about state-to-state conversions. That's the purview of entanglement theory. And we want to talk about state-to-box conversions, namely the interplay between non-locality and entanglement. So let's start with the boxes. If you have a box, what can you do to convert it into another box? Well, we argue extensively in this paper that the set of free operations should be taken to be local operations in shared randomness. I won't go through the argument here. I'll just note that it was also proposed as far back as 2014 by DiVincente. So what do these operations look like on this given box here in black? Well, the most general thing Alice can do, as we said earlier, to transform her classical channel into a classical channel is a comb of this sort. Bob can do a comb similarly, and the two can coordinate their choice of combs with their shared randomness. So that's the most general LOSR transformation from boxes to boxes. What about state-to-box conversions? Well, under this assumption that we're looking for a unified resource theory, what we argue in our paper is that simply the fact that conversion relations in a resource theory must be transitive, that is, if R1 goes to R2 for free and R2 goes to R3 for free, then R1 goes to R3 for free, it follows that state-to-box conversions also need to be evaluated relative to LOSR. And this is in contrast to the sort of by default assumption in the literature that such transformations are evaluated relative to just local measurements or local operations. So traditionally, people take a quantum state. They imagine Alice performs one of a set of classical measurements depending on some input setting and gets some outcome. Bob does similarly. So this is how you traditionally convert an entangled state to a box. But we're allowing slightly more generality than that. We allow them to coordinate their choice of measurements with shared randomness. And that you're forced to do that if you want a unified resource theory simply by transitivity. And similarly, by transitivity, when you look at state-to-state conversions, again, we argue as a result of this, the fact that state-to-box conversions have to be evaluated relative to LOSR, it follows that state-to-state conversions also have to be evaluated relative to LOSR. And this is in contrast to the traditional idea that entanglement theory should be based around LOCC operations. So what do these operations look like in LOSR? Here's our bipartite entangled state. Alice and Bob can implement their local operations to transform the state, and they can also coordinate their choice of local operations with shared randomness. So these are the types of conversions that are free in our resource theory. So in other words, in Bell scenarios, the relevant notions of entanglement, non-locality, and the interplay between the two are all captured within a single resource theory that defined by taking LOSR operations to be free. Does anybody have any questions at this point? All right. So I want to now give you some dividends of studying the resource theory of local operations and shared randomness to show you that this is a productive research agenda. So, and furthermore, each of these can be viewed as further motivation why one should study LOSR in a Bell scenario. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to resolve the anomalies of non-locality. Then I'm going to provide a better notion of genuine multipartite entanglement and genuine multipartite non-locality. And then I'm going to clarify and extend the notion of self-testing. Okay, so first, resolving the anomalies of non-locality. What are these? Well, it's been recognized in a bunch of previous papers that there exist some measures of non-locality which you can only maximize if you have a partially entangled state. You can't maximize them if you only have a maximally entangled state. To put it succinctly, as Wittig and Venner did, sometimes you need less entanglement to get more non-locality, which has been viewed as very surprising and termed an anomaly. And another common sort of summary of this fact is people say entanglement and non-locality are inequivalent. They're just different kinds of resources. You have to give up on the idea that that they're related in any close way as resources. So let's consider this in detail. So consider the family of states given by cosine theta 0,0 plus sine theta 1,1. This is the family of states that interpolates between the product states and the maximally entangled state phi plus. As theta goes from 0 to pi over 4. And we know from Nielsen's theorem, sort of central result in LOCC entanglement theory, that the amount of LOCC entanglement in this state is strictly and monotonically increasing as theta increases. So if you consider using these states to generate non-locality, you'd expect the maximally entangled state, which can generate all the other states, to be as good as all the other states, at least, if not better, at generating non-locality. But if you measure non-locality using the probability of running a Hardy proof of non-locality, or the violation of a particular tilted Bell inequality, or the extractable secret key rate, or the relative entropy distance from some local set, or a host of other such measures that you can find in the literature, what people observed was the optimal state is not the maximally entangled state. It's some particular optimal theta that's strictly less than pi over 4. So that's the anomaly. How is it that the maximally entangled state performs strictly worse at generating any of these forms of non-locality? And I'll point out that in each of these cases, the optimal theta is different as well. So let's focus on just one of these. I'll focus on what I think was chronologically the first one, the probability of running a Hardy proof of non-locality. So what is Lucien's proof of non-locality? Well, it runs as follows. You start with a particular state that I'll call the Hardy state, and it's a partially entangled state. And Alice and Bob perform some particular measurements on it and convert it into a box, which I'll call the Hardy box, which is characterized by this set of conditional probability distributions. So the particular numbers and state and everything here won't matter. What matters is that Lucien argued that under the assumption of local hidden variables, these particular correlations allow you to run a chain of counterfactual inferences that generate a contradiction. And it's critical here that these three numbers are zero and this number is non-zero. This number is the probability that you sort of get off the ground in running this contradiction. And the reason this was interesting is because it's a proof of non-locality that doesn't run through inequalities in the same way that Bell originally did. What else was interesting in this scenario was that Lucien showed that one cannot generate such a proof using the maximally entangled state phi plus. You can generate it with any partially entangled state, but not with the maximally entangled state. So that was viewed as quite surprising, and it's one of these anomalies that people have pointed out. Let me now give a new spin on the same argument, a resource theoretic spin. So entanglement theory tells us that the maximally entangled state goes to the Hardy state. And by the definitions on the previous slide, the Hardy state goes to the Hardy box. But what Lucien showed was that the maximally entangled state doesn't go to the Hardy box. So this looks like a contradiction. It looks like not just an anomaly, not just something you have to get used to that's counterintuitive, but rather it looks like a strict contradiction. Because in any resource theory, the conversion relations are transitive. So if phi plus goes to psi Hardy, which goes to the Hardy box, then how can it be that phi plus does not go to the Hardy box? But you might already see the problem here based on how I've presented things in this talk. These are not all conversion relations within a unified resource theory. The first one is evaluated relative to LOCC, and the last two are evaluated relative to local operations. And we've argued that in all three of these cases, one should be asking about these conversion relations relative to LOSR. So if we reevaluate whether these conversions are all possible with respect to LOSR, we find that the last two are unchanged, but this first relation, which is possible under LOCC, is not possible under LOSR. And now the three conversion relations are consistent, and it's transitive as you'd expect. And furthermore, not only can phi plus not go to psi Hardy, but psi Hardy can't go to phi plus, so these two states are incomparable. Neither one is strictly more LOSR entangled than the other. And hence the terms maximally entangled and partially entangled are just not appropriate for LOSR entanglement, unlike in LOCC entanglement, where it makes sense to say that phi plus is strictly more entangled than psi Hardy. Here they're incomparable. So going back to that family of states, we furthermore show in our paper that all of these states are incomparable to each other. So as soon as there's any incomparability, as I mentioned earlier, there's no single measure of that form of resourcefulness. So here, there's no single measure of LOSR entanglement. There will be many measures. For example, the measure above, increasing LOCC entanglement, you can think of theta here. Theta itself is a monotone, which captures this increasing LOCC entanglement. It also is a valid LOSR monotone. So as theta increases, the LOSR entanglement also increases. But that's just one monotone. There's another monotone which goes exactly in the other direction. So this is like the minus theta monotone. As theta increases, the LOSR entanglement according to this measure decreases strictly and monotonically. So for each anomaly, furthermore, if you look at the associated task, generating a Hardy paradox, generating a secret key, etc., each such task has its own optimal state, as I said, and it defines a monotone which is peaked at that state. So here, for example, if this is just a cartoon of one such optimal state, there'll be a monotone that witnesses that fact because it's maximized at that theta, and then there's another task which has some other optimum and some other monotone that witnesses it. So from the point of view of LOSR entanglement, not only is it not anomalous that there exist these tasks for which the maximally entangled state phi plus is not optimal, it's logically necessary that there have to be such tasks for which these other states are the optimal states. So to conclude this section, the usual conclusion people have drawn from looking at these anomalies is that non-locality and entanglement are different resources. They're just inequivalent somehow. And our conclusion is non-locality and LOCC entanglement are different resources. That's true, but there was no reason to expect these two to be related anyway. In contrast, non-locality and LOSR entanglement are manifestations of the same resource, namely non-classicality of common cause processes. And indeed, as I said, there is no anomaly of non-locality when one quantifies entanglement with respect to LOSR rather than LOCC. Rather, you see that the interplay between non-locality and entanglement is nice and harmonious. Any questions about the anomalies?
Yes, David?
Yeah.
Just asking, like, the fact that there is no anomaly, is it for you, is there more argument to say that there would be the same manifestation, or is it just like an intuition because indeed the anomalies we introduced are no longer existing?
The thing that the more careful statement is basically what I said here, that with respect to LOCC entanglement, the maximally entangled, the most resourceful object is not the most useful for generating non-locality. But in the LOSR resource theory, there are many measures of what it means to be maximally valuable or maximally LOSR entangled. And the state which is most useful for generating a particular kind of non-locality is a maximally resourceful or a maximally LOSR entangled state, according to the measure which is defined by that task. So it's no longer sort of, there's no surprise. It's logically necessary that things be this way. And it comes to the fact, it comes down to the fact that the CC are distinct from those in LOSR. So the way that you quantify and measure the amount of entanglement in the state will be different for LOCC and for LOSR as well. So it's no longer surprising that one had this anomaly with respect to LOCC. And once you measure things using LOSR entanglement measures, it's no longer true that sort of the most resourceful object is not the most useful. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, I guess my question was more, it's probably what you told us, does LOSR entanglement always give us the best measure of non-locality? Because we showed that LOCC is not good enough, but did you show that everything works when you take LOSR, or is it?
So I'm not sure what the notion of everything works means here is, but I would argue that it satisfactorily resolves these anomalies. And as I said, for each of the different specific instances of the anomaly, there's an associated task which witnesses the optimal state.
Okay, I see. Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Okay, so there isn't a unique measure here, but there's a set of LOSR measures. And if you take that set together, it'll give you all the information that you need.
David?
Yeah.
So is the claim essentially that under LOSR, all the theta values are kind of incomparable, maybe apart from 0 and pi over 4, and therefore you can more or less draw any function monotone you want on that, which will be kind of valid because everything's incomparable.
That's right. Within this family of states, everything's incomparable. And so, in fact, any function on this set of states will be a valid monotone. So you might want to look at particular ones that are operationally motivated, maybe by the tasks defined in these anomalies, for example. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Thanks.
Did you, just following up on that, can you hear me?
Yep.
Does that mean, I mean, is it possible to just construct a continuum of operational tasks? Can you imagine doing that?
Yes, and in fact, there have been such a continuum of operational tasks, namely violating the tilted Bell inequalities. So there's a continuous parameter, the tilt, that as you vary the tilt of those inequalities, the optimal theta just sweeps here from 0 to pi over 4. I mean, 0 is never... zero is free, but apart from zero, there's a particular Bell inequality that can be optimized by exactly each value of theta and no other state.
Thanks.
Okay, any more? All right, so moving on to the second dividend of studying LOSR entanglement theory, we're gonna give a better definition of genuine multipartite entanglement and genuine multipartite non-locality. So let's start with an example, two particular states, the GHZ state, and the state that I'll call psi 2 Bell, which is just a pair of Bell states. So a pair of maximally entangled states, one held between Alice and Bob, the other shared between Alice and Charlie. So if we ask ourselves which of these is genuinely three-way entangled, intuitively the first one genuinely has some three-way correlations. The second one definitely doesn't, because it's just a pair of bipartite entangled states. So surely any good definition of genuine three-way correlation or entanglement would agree with this intuition. But if we look at the traditional definition from the literature, this is how it's defined. A tripartite state is genuinely three-way entangled if and only if it is not a mixture of states that are biseparable, that is, separable with respect to partitionings of the parties into two groups. And you can see that neither of these states satisfies this definition. Sorry, both of them satisfy this definition, because both of these states are pure states, so they're not mixtures, and yet they're not separable with respect to any partitioning of the parties into two groups. So that's the first pathology of this definition.
David?
Yes.
Can I ask one question? So yes. In the psi 2 Bell, you have, it's a three-party system, right?
That's right.
So if Alice and Bob are maximally entangled using like Bell state, then it is not going to be maximally entangled with Charlie, right?
So this is, I'm assuming that Alice here effectively has a four-dimensional system.
Okay.
So she's holding two qubits. And one of them is half of this entangled state. The other one is half of this entangled state.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Right. So the first sort of pathology of this definition is that it deems both of these states genuinely three-way entangled, in contrast to this strong intuition here. And in fact, we show in the paper that you can cast this as an anomaly of three-way non-locality in analogy to the anomalies that I presented earlier. A second pathology of this definition is that the set of states which are not genuinely three-way entangled is not closed under tensor product. And you can see that just from this example here, because this state is composed of two bipartite states, each of which is not genuinely three-way entangled, but when you tensor them together, suddenly you get a state which is supposed to be genuinely three-way entangled by this definition. So that's a bit unusual, and furthermore, it violates the assumption that the free set in any resource theory be closed. So it's not something that can be formalized as a resource theory. And it's a little unclear to me why this definition ever gained a lot of traction, but I think one argument that might have been proposed to defend it is if you look at LOCC entanglement theory, the pair of Bell states can be converted to the GHZ state. It suffices to note that Alice could locally prepare the GHZ state and then use her two Bell pairs to perform two instances of teleportation to send the halves of the GHZ state to Bob and to Charlie. So this conversion is possible in LOCC. So you might have thought that whatever type of entanglement is embodied in psi GHZ, it must be embodied in psi 2 Bell as well. And hence, if you say the GHZ state is genuinely three-way entangled, then you would be forced to conclude that the pair of Bell states is also genuinely three-way entangled. So maybe that's an argument why people thought that you were forced to this conclusion, despite how counterintuitive it is. But of course, from our point of view, LOCC entanglement need not be, it's not relevant here. So let's take a step back and let's say, how should one define genuine three-way entanglement? What should those words be taken to mean? Well, I would say it's that which cannot be generated by arbitrary bipartite entanglement and three-way shared randomness. So in other words, a state is genuinely three-way entangled if and only if it can not be decomposed as follows. So here's the decomposition of the given tripartite state, where every pair of parties shares a arbitrary bipartite quantum state, and they might share some arbitrary tripartite shared randomness. And then they do whatever processings they want locally to turn that into their quantum output. So any state decomposable like this does not have genuine three-way entanglement. If it doesn't decompose as this, then it does have genuine three-way entanglement. And we can make the analogous definition for boxes. The only thing that changes is that now we're considering decompositions of a box with a tripartite box with classical inputs and outputs. So these processings that each party does on their shared bipartite entanglement and tripartite classical common cause have classical inputs and outputs. So this is our proposed definition, and I think it's been studied in one or two papers in the last year or two as well. So the advantages of this new definition, well, first of all, it respects common sense. So for this example, this pair of bipartite entangled states is not genuinely three-way entangled, and the GHZ state is genuinely three-way entangled. It doesn't exhibit this anomaly of multipartite non-locality. And the set of non-genuinely three-way entangled states, according to this definition, is in fact closed under tensor product. So it satisfies the assumptions of a valid resource theory, which means that one can quantify this notion of genuine three-way entanglement and study it with all the usual tools that a resource theory provides. Okay, any more questions on genuine three-way entanglement and non-locality? All right, so the last dividend of studying LOSR entanglement theory is clarifying and extending the notion of self-testing. So first of all, what is self-testing? Well, self-testing is usually motivated by saying you want to learn something about the internal components of a physical process, or maybe some device that you bought at the store, without opening it up and testing the individual components. So for example, the kind of canonical example people bring up in this sphere is, if you measure some bipartite system and you observe some box where the inputs and outputs are space-like separated among the two different wings, and this box achieves the quantum maximum violation of the CHSH inequality, then the state that was used must have been the LOCC maximally entangled state. Of course, this isn't quite true. There's never a unique state that can generate a given box. There's a family of maximally entangled states that could have generated the box. So there's some kind of freedom in how well you can certify what's the internal components of this box. So self-testing is defined up to this freedom. So here's the traditional definition of self-testing. To say that psi is self-tested by a box B is to say that the box can be obtained by local measurements on a state phi only if phi can be mapped to psi tensor chi for some chi by a local isometry. So if you're not familiar with self-testing and that seems like a bit much, don't stress out. I'm going to give you a better definition that's a lot easier to understand on the next slide. But for now, I want to just note that this definition it's only defined for pure states. And in fact, there are multiple papers in the literature claiming that mixed states cannot be self-tested. And there's no a priori justification, at least that I'm aware of, for why you would choose local isometries here. It was just settled upon as a good notion of self-testing that leads to interesting results. So before I get to our definition, I want to point out two views on self-testing that you can find in the literature. And usually people don't really distinguish, they conflate these two views. The first is that the goal of self-testing is to infer that whatever state was used to generate a box, one could extract psi from it. So that's the definition that you see in here. It says there's some state phi which can generate the box B, and you can extract psi from it by a local isometry. The second view of self-testing, that the goal is to uniquely identify the state psi that was used to generate B. So you're not just trying to identify that you could extract psi from the state that was used. You're trying to claim that it really was psi that was used. So the second goal is strictly harder than the first goal. And the first goal is the one that's formally captured by this definition. So let's stick with the first goal for now. The goal is to infer that one can extract the given state, rho, from the state that was used to generate the box. We like this idea, but we've already argued that the appropriate set of operations for both state-to-state and state-to-box conversions is local operations and shared randomness. So here's our resource theoretic definition of self-testing. We say that a density operator rho is self-tested by a box B if it holds that rho can generate B, and also any other state, sigma, that can generate B can also generate rho, where all of these conversions are evaluated relative to LOSR. So to put it very simply, rho is the least LOSR entangled state that can generate B. That's what this definition says. It says rho can generate B, and every other state that can generate B can also generate rho. So rho is the least LOSR entangled state that can generate B. That's all you have to say what self-testing is. Is everyone happy with this definition? All right, so that was our definition of self-testing, but we show in the paper that it coincides with the traditional definition of self-testing for pure states. So the articulation of the freedom of a state in the conventional definition, which had something to do with local isometries and pure states, it's nothing more than the condition for LOSR convertibility in the case of pure states. But an advantage of our definition is our definition also applies to mixed states. Oh, and a first advantage is that we have an a priori motivation and justification for our choice of operations. Whereas, as I said, I don't know of any such justification for choosing local isometries. But a more practical advantage of our definition is that it applies to a broader class of objects. In particular, mixed states can be self-tested. It's easy to see that some mixed states can be self-tested. We give an example in our paper. We show that this state here, this family of states here, if the pure state psi can be self-tested, then this family of mixed states can also be self-tested for any probability distribution Pij and local unitaries Ua and Ub. But admittedly, this is a fairly particular mixed state. So this raises the question, what about more generic mixed states? You know, what's the scope of all mixed states you can self-test? We're not sure yet, but it's an important question because if the answer is yes, generic states can be self-tested, then this will have nice implications for robust self-testing because, of course, the ideal of purity is never achieved in a real experiment. So we'd like to have definitions that apply to the mixed states as well. Okay, so coming back to the second view on self-testing, the second view was that the goal of self-testing is to uniquely identify the state rho that was used to generate the observed box B. And the problem is, if rho can generate a box B, then so can any state that's more LOSR entangled. That was literally the definition of self-testing, was that if rho can generate B, then any state that can also generate rho can also generate B. So the question then is, when is it possible to uniquely identify the state that was used to generate a box? Well, if you're promised that the set of states from which rho is being drawn contains states that are all pairwise incomparable or equivalent, in other words, there's no strict orderings among the states that you're drawing from, then you can hope to uniquely identify the LOSR equivalence class that could have generated the box B. So this motivates the search for sets of states that are pairwise incomparable. And I've already given you one such set of states, we said that all two-qubit pure states, which can be parameterized like this, are incomparable. And in fact, we show in our paper that any two bipartite pure states of equal Schmidt rank are LOSR incomparable, or equivalent if they have the same Schmidt coefficients. So this is the special case of this more general result when the Schmidt rank is 2. And this, in fact, explains why all bipartite pure states of a given Schmidt rank can not only be self-tested, but they can also be uniquely identified from the boxes that they generate. It's precisely because no two such states are strictly ordered. If they were strictly ordered, then you'd never know that it was this particular state that generated the box rather than all the other states in this family that are more entangled. But because they're incomparable, you know you won't run into that problem. We have some more discussion in our paper about further generalizations of self-testing. So for example, you can self-test objects that aren't entangled states. You could self-test things like steering assemblages or bipartite channels or any other type of LOSR resource. So here's a list of 10 types of resources that you can find in the literature. And you can find them all unified into a single resource theory, namely the one defined by LOSR operations that can change between types. We do that in this paper here. And not only can you self-test all of these resources in the framework of local operations and shared randomness, but you can also self-test resources in other types of resource theories. We have some discussion of sort of what scope of resource theories can have self-testing in our paper. And we also talk a bit about a weaker notion of self-testing that always succeeds, but it's either more or less informative depending on what box is observed. Okay. So moving on from self-testing, maybe I should ask if there are any questions first. All right. So some other results about LOSR entanglement theory. I'll just point these out as bullet points in case you're interested in what else is in our paper. We give an analog of Nielsen's theorem. That is, we give a necessary and sufficient condition for when LOSR conversions between two bipartite pure states are possible. We give a proof that there are no catalytic conversions between bipartite pure states. And we give some other results relating the LOSR preorder to equivalence under local unitaries, some necessary conditions for conversions among n-partite states, some monotones, and some more discussion of self-testing, an equivalent characterization of our definition that's more abstract. Okay. So I want to end with a quote from our paper. The fact that researchers have previously taken LOCC entanglement rather than LOSR entanglement as the appropriate notion in Bell scenarios has led to the view that the interplay between entanglement and non-locality is rather perverse. We have shown, however, that this perversity is merely an artifact of considering the wrong notion of entanglement. Once one focuses on LOSR entanglement, the interplay with non-locality is found to be quite natural. So this then motivates a new branch of entanglement theory where the free operations are LOSR rather than LOCC. We've given some basic results along that vein. But there's a lot of more results that need to be revisited. Things like the Perez conjecture, distillation, Werner states, entanglement in networks. Basically, any time LOCC entanglement was used to do some analysis, you have to ask yourself, was it the right set of free operations or should we have used a different set like LOSR? And in fact, keep in mind that LOCC entanglement is also applied in very broad fields such as condensed matter or cosmology or things like that. And it's unclear that LOCC is the right notion to quantify entanglement in such cases. You really have to revisit. So here we've been focused on Bell scenarios, but in more general contexts, you just have to go back to the basics and figure out what the right set of free operations is. If it turns out to be LOSR rather than LOCC, then you know there's a lot of potential work to be done and potentially revisionary work to be done in understanding what's going on. So most of what I've talked about can be found in this paper. If you found it compelling, then I recommend the second paper, which takes this kind of type-independent resource theory framework seriously and tries to incorporate as many different types of resources as possible. You can also find an extensive collection of results on the resource theory of non-locality in this paper. And that's all I wanted to say. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, so do you have questions for David?
I have a question. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question about the Paris conjecture. So the thing to show here would be that every state that gives rise to a non-local correlation should be LOSR distillable. Is that that would be a resolution of that anomaly in a way, right?
I think there's some work to be done, even posing what the right analog of the Perez conjecture here is, requires some work. So first of all, distillation is usually the idea is you're trying to distill the maximally entangled state, say 0, 0 plus 1, 1. Whereas here, that's no longer sort of the unique maximally entangled state. Any other bipartite entangled state, can be viewed as maximal in some sense. So it's not clear what you're trying to distill to. Are you trying to distill to one particular state or another? Once you've decided on your notion of distillation, then yes, maybe you'd want to prove something like what you suggested.
But wouldn't it be sensible, like in this lattice that you showed in the beginning, if it can be distilled to any maximal element in that lattice, wouldn't that be like a sensible requirement for distillability under LSR?
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to study whether it could distill to any maximal element. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, can I jump in, David?
Yeah.
Just a comment that the proof that the Paris conjecture is false in the multipartite case also goes through for this LOSR redefinition. So if you decide you want to define distillation relative to states that are LOCC maximally entangled, then the paper by I can't remember who the authors were, but that shows that a Paris conjecture is false goes through for this LOSR version as well.
Right, so that might motivate looking at distillation to maximal elements that are not maximal in the LOCC entanglement theory.
David, could you said you have a version of Nielsen's theorem, but for LOSR, could you describe that in words?
Yeah, I should have prepared a slide on that. So we give a necessary and sufficient condition for when LOSR conversions between two bipartite pure states are possible. So recall that Nielsen's theorem gave an analogous condition, but where the conversions are LOCC conversions. And the criterion was just the Schmidt coefficients of one bipartite entangled state majorize the Schmidt coefficients of the other. Mm-hmm. And so for our case, it's that I might get the order backwards here. A state phi can be converted to a state psi if the Schmidt coefficients of psi can be written as the tensor product of the Schmidt coefficients of phi with some arbitrary probability vector.
Okay. So can you give an example?
When they're ordered in decreasing order as usual.
Can you give an example of
a non-trivial conversion?
A non-trivial conversion, yeah, just to.
Yes, I can. Let me jump to that slide. Can everyone see this still?
Oh yeah, you said this.
So here is a conversion that is possible. So we have the basic idea is we have effectively mm-hmm. the same kind of state in the 2-3 subspace as in the 0-1 subspace. So you could do a projection to subspaces. Both parties would, end up in the same subspace. They know what subspace they're in. So then they could apply an operation to map 2 to 0 and 3 to 1 and hence implement such a conversion. But definitely there's far fewer conversions that are possible in this resource theory than there are in the LOSR resource theory.
Very interesting. Are there more questions?
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I guess you mentioned this, but for instance, you said that in applications like in condensed matter, it's not clear whether, like, so of course people look at LOCC entanglement, like entanglement entropies, no? Things like this.
Yeah.
But it's not very clear whether you should choose LOCC versus LOSR.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it seems clear from like the many practical results I've seen that entanglement entropy tells you something interesting. For instance,
right. Condensed
matter,
yes.
Systems,
yes.
Networks, no?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. So the thing to realize is that every LOCC monotone is still an LOSR monotone because LOSR is strictly contained in LOCC. So if a conversion is impossible under LOCC, then it's also impossible under LOSR. So that means if people are using LOCC monotones, whether if either LOSR or LOCC is the appropriate resource theory, then LOCC monotones will be useful in either case. It's just that they won't be sufficient. There will be more monotones than just the LOCC ones. There will be new monotones that are LOSR monotones, but not LOCC monotones. And those will give you strictly more information. So it's not that they'll be getting results that are somehow wrong. It's that they won't be getting all the results that they could get. So they'll be missing certain discriminating features if they don't use LOSR entanglement theory when they should be.
Okay.
I mean, it's also possible that it's neither LOSR nor LOCC, but something else that I don't know how to articulate.
Yeah,
it's probably not local operations, because then classical correlations would be deemed valuable. But I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
Yeah, yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah.
Any more questions? No. Well, then I suggest, I don't know how this works, but I suggest we unmute and thank David. So, thank you.
Thank you.